tá fáilte rás go dtíon uair Gaelic an seo ar chin 98.9. Welcome to the Gaelic Hour here on chin 97.9 FM with Austin Cummerton on this practically balmy Monday evening, broadcasting live from downtown in the market here in the national capital, Ottawa. That was an interesting piece there just on the news that the pub down in Montreal, McKibbins, are arguing that their signage is art. And the Language Commission are having to review the rulings because they're unilingual. An interesting scenario. Lots going on. As usual, we have a full program put together for you. Tonight, we are going to talk to Archbishop Prendergast. He's going to tell us about his Irish heritage. And then I have a little piece on the 40th celebrations that are underway with the Ottawa Welsh Choir, and they're happening later on in the month, and we'll tell you all about those. And I also have an interview with Mike Burns. Mike Burns will be down at St. Bridget's Irish Canadian Cultural Centre on the 23rd of the month, and you'll get information on that also. But as usual, there's a lot going on in the city. Every week on Monday, Tuesday and Wednesdays, even though it's early in the week, it's packed with activities. Mondays at 6:30, you can head out to Blessed Sacrament, and that's at 194 4th Avenue, where you can learn some Irish dancing, or you can learn to speak the language. And that has been going on, and there's a steady flow of people go through that. It's amazing how there is such interest in the Irish language and Irish dance. And many of the people who are learning have no connection whatsoever, really, with Ireland. Yes, they have maybe generations back, but it's not as if that they had it and lost it. They're coming to the language and learning it. And then on Tuesdays between 11 and 2, the Irish Society have a sponsored seniors drop-in, and that's over at St. Margaret Mary's at Sunnyside in Fairburn. And again, that's a wonderful place. If you want to mix with people, get to know people, head over there. And on Wednesdays at 6:30, there are sit dance classes, and they're 1026 Baseline Road over in Nepean. And of course, every Wednesday to Saturday, there's live music down at the Irish Village at in the market in Clarence. And I want to express my gratitude to the ongoing support that I receive from the Irish Village, which enables this program to stay broadcasting. And this week down there, the Whiskey Dealers, Silver Creek, Big Slick, and Cooper Voice, then on Mother McGinty's on Thursday, Friday and Saturday night. But the other thing that will be coming up at the weekend, of course, is rugby. And that starts down there at 10 o'clock on Saturday morning. Wales versus Italy at 10 a.m., Ireland versus Scotland at noon, and France versus England at 3 p.m. And it's just $15. That gets you in for the day for all the games. But time to move on, and time to meet our new Archbishop here, Archbishop Terence Prendergast.
You're listening to the Gaelic Hour on Chin 97.9 FM with Austin Cameron. And I have the honour of sitting down with our Archbishop Terence Prendergast. Archbishop Prendergast, welcome to the Gaelic Hour.
Thank you very much, Austin.
And for the listeners here, they're very aware that Terence Prendergast is a good, solid Irish name. And it is the first non-Francophone in this position for a long, long time, if not ever.
Well, there was a Bishop Gaultier who actually was Scottish,
right,
even though his name was French, and there was a Bishop Forbes, who I guess was French even though his name was English.
But, okay.
And Bishop Gervais really was an English speaker, even if he was had a French name.
So, Terence Prendergast, where does the family roots, how far back do they link back to the Green Isle?
Well, my grandfather, my mother's side, was born in Ireland, in Glenamaddy. The family name was Scarry, sometimes pronounced Scarry. It's not commonly known outside of a few places. What surprised me when I was in Halifax is that there's about 22 or 23 Scarrys in the phone book there. Whether they're relatives or not of mine, I don't know. But the name is otherwise not found in phone books in Ottawa or Toronto or New York, mm-hmm, or whatever. I have a cousin who lives in California. He's about the only one carrying the name. All the others were girls, and so when they lost the name, it's Scarry when they got married. So my grandmother's Scarry's maiden name was Prendergast. No relation to my father's.
Okay.
So I had Prendergast on both sides of my family. Now, my grandmother was born in Liverpool, and my mother was born in Widnes. And she emigrated with her mother and other four siblings in 1926 to Montreal. All the others had the common sense to move further south where there was a different climate, but my mother stayed in Montreal, where she married John Prendergast, who was born in Cupid's Newfoundland. And apparently the legend has it that the story has it in the background. We've lost the records because of fires in the churches in Burgess in Newfoundland. That there were seven brothers who came from around the area of Cork in the south to Newfoundland, to Belle Island. And from there they spread across Newfoundland and then I guess some in Canada. So I have people who have asked me if I'm related to the Prendergast from Cape Breton or from Belle Island. I really don't know. I do have some uncles. One who lived in Toronto and one who lived in Montreal, but he never married, so we didn't have any Prendergast there. And my uncle, Bill Prendergast, had four daughters and one son. So there's one Prendergast in Toronto area who's my relative.
So growing up was part of your culture. Were you introduced to the Irishness in your culture?
We were very Irish. St. Patrick's Day was a big day. My dad, when he bought a house in the north end of Montreal in 1949, decided since St. Patrick's Day was a day off for the Irish-speaking employees, that was the day we would move. So on St. Patrick's Day 1949, my family moved, when I was 5 years old, moved to north end of Montreal, Hunsick, to a parish called St. Rita's, where there are many Irish, like us, scattered among the major Francophone population there. And so we had a Father Healy and a Father Fitzpatrick, who are our priests, and so we always had St. Patrick's Day plays, concerts, performances, whatnot. It was a wonderful time. We learned all the old Irish-American St. Patrick's Day songs, and some of the ones from the old sod, and we could weep with the thoughts of Ireland like everybody else. I didn't know very much what it was about, but I had a sense that St. Patrick was important. We heard homilies and talks about St. Patrick, and we put out the shamrocks and so on, and we had a big parade in Montreal when I was a kid. We always went down to the parade on the Sunday near St. Patrick's Day. So again, I would say those were the kind of Irish external celebrations, and I suppose the rest of it was the kind of Irish English cuisine that my mom had cooked up and that my dad knew from Newfoundland. So much more than that I can't say.
So growing up then, at what stage did you consider, particularly the background that you came from, that you had a vocation, and would that influence have been?
The vocation came in large part, I suppose, from the fact that I was an altar server, and I guess I did fairly well at it. I learned my Latin answers well, and I was pretty faithful about attending Mass during the week. So I would say maybe every second week I would serve Mass at 6:30 or 7 or 7:30 in the morning. At that time, we didn't have a church, so we went to the rectory where each priest had his Mass in the morning. There were three priests. And then at the end of my elementary school, one of the priests said to me, "Have you ever thought about being a priest?" Which I hadn't. I suppose maybe when you're that age, it becomes later, but I hadn't thought about it, but I wasn't averse to it. And once the seed got planted, I kind of kept it up. So when I went through high school, I was thinking of the priesthood, and I was attracted to the Jesuits because they were my teachers. And so at the end of my my high school years, I went to tell my priest friend, Father Fitzpatrick, that I had something to say, and I didn't know how to say it. He said, "Well, you're going to be a Jesuit." And I said, "Yes." And he said, "That's great." He said, they were very supportive of me. I think they would have liked me to be a diocesan priest, but they were happy that I was going to be a priest. And the irony, of course, is that almost all my ministry has been in training diocesan clergy, and now I'm a bishop for diocesan priests, so God has a funny way of bringing things together.
So, after you were ordained, where were you posted, or where did you spend?
Well, actually, my first 3 years, I was ordained in Toronto in 1972. I entered the Jesuits in 1961 after high school, so a long 11-year training program, including 2 years teaching in Montreal at my high school. And then since I was doing theology and was interested in a graduate degree in theology, then started a doctoral program, I stayed on, and actually for my first 3 years of priesthood, I was posted as a graduate student at Toronto, at the University of Toronto, Toronto School of Theology. I followed a program in Scripture, in Old Testament, New Testament, and wrote a dissertation on St. Mark's Gospel. In 1975, I was invited to, so that's to be 3 years after my ordination, I was invited to take a teaching position in Nova Scotia, where I would also be expected to work with seminarians So I went with my doctorate unfinished. I had 2 years more to take in summer times and spare times to write the dissertation. I completed in the summer of 77, defended in the spring of 98, and graduated in the spring of, in May of 1998 with my doctorate. So the first few years of priesthood, I would help out in parishes on weekends and would give retreats in the summertime, but basically I was a student. I was doing doctoral studies. And then when I went to Nova Scotia, I spent the years teaching, and in the summers I worked on my dissertation. The first summer I worked in Halifax, and then the second summer I was too well known there and I had been too distracted, so I went back up to Toronto, completed the dissertation that summer, and then went back to teaching. So really I didn't have very much parish work except on weekends and summer supply. So my ministry basically has been in education. I was a teacher for 6 years in Halifax and director of formation for the seminarians there, the Atlantic School of Theology. And then I went to Toronto to do the same thing at Regis College, the Jesuit seminary in Toronto. I was the rector then, and so I also taught New Testament. So I did have part-time administration of Jesuits and part-time teaching. After a dozen years teaching then, I was granted a sabbatical, so I went to Rome and spent a year at the Biblical Institute redoing my courses and looking up new stuff and getting caught up on the scholarship. The following year, I was asked to be a visiting professor in Saskatchewan at the University of Regina, Campbell College, or Jesuit College there. So I taught Old and New Testament that year, and then returned to Toronto, where I was a professor, but also became dean of theology, and did that really until my next sabbatical, which was the 1994-95, when I went to the Ecole Biblique in Jerusalem as a visiting professor in Bible. It was basically a sabbatical, but with one seminar that I would teach. And it was during that time that I was named a bishop, auxiliary bishop of Toronto. So that's basically what my ministry has been like. And so I've gotten to know parish work really through working with the priests in the dioceses of Toronto, 3.5 years as auxiliary there, 9 years as Archbishop of Halifax, along with 5.5 years also administering the Diocese of Yarmouth, French and English, so that's where I get my French came back. And then just this past year here in Ottawa.
being a child to today, a lot has changed. You would have seen how your parents reacted to and interacted with the church. And in your capacity in teaching, you would have seen various generations of students come through. Things have changed radically. The relationship of people to the clergy, to the church, to their spiritual life, everything. How do you see that, and where do you see things today?
I'll give you two specific sections, I guess, of life, if you will, just to show the change in my life and the life of the young people I deal with. I sometimes explain this when I'm talking about the needs for youth ministry these days in Ottawa and in Canada generally. When I was a child and I grew up, our world was Catholic, gravitated around the church. So when we went to church on Friday night to the church hall, we played floor hockey and we danced and we played ping pong and we did cards and we did all kinds of stuff. It was a social place.
Mm-hmm.
Because the whole Catholic world was taken for granted. The prayer and the home, Sunday devotions, the mission, all those kinds of things. It was a kind of, not that we did it in the ghetto, but I think we did need a kind of reinforcement for our faith, and so the parish church was naturally that. Also, our people were not very wealthy. They were paying the mortgages of their homes. They were basically simple people. My dad had been came from a fisherman's family. He had grade 7 education. My mother, as an immigrant, she had only grade school. They wanted the best for their kids. They wanted me to get a good high school education, a good college education. So the values that they had not had, they wanted us to have. When I compare that with the children, the young people that I got to know in Nova Scotia, because they had no Catholics, very few Catholic schools in Nova Scotia. We had one private school and one new school that we started when I was there. But basically no funding for Catholic schools in Nova Scotia. So the children, the young people, the teenagers, the young adults, when they come together in the Catholic Church, what do they want the church to provide? They want to prepare, they want us to have for them a prayer environment. They've got all the sports at school and in society. That's all provided now. What's not provided is a place where they can be safe and pray. So we would often have Eucharistic adoration, we would have prayer and worship. The young kids love singing and praying spontaneously before God and before the Blessed Sacrament. They love going to confession, which is provided for them. They always ask us to have confession, which is sometimes their parents are running away from. You know, so you can see how the changes take place just there. So I would say there's been a radical transformation of both church and world. And so the needs of the church today are just different, and we have to try to find the best way of delivering those goods. In Catholic schools in Ontario, there are a lot of fine things about it, but some kids, in a way, going to a Catholic school get inoculated against their faith. Kind of puzzling thing in some ways. They think they know it all, and yet, in a way, they've learned it intellectually, perhaps, but they have not taken it in their hearts. They don't have a relationship with our Lord. They don't have a sense of feeling for the church or for the sacraments. That's the challenge there. And how to overcome that, I don't know. That's one of the things I'm working. That's why I've begun visiting schools. I've been to three high schools in the last little while, taking up questions and trying to meet them, trying to invite them to see themselves as church. The other area I would say is ecumenism. When I came to study theology, Toronto School of Theology was just starting. My class was the first to enter the federated Toronto School of Theology, 7 colleges where you could go and take courses in any of the traditions and so on. And so we really went all out to affirm the ecumenical dimension of our faith. And we went into it both boots and full throttles, full steam ahead. And I think we were interested in specifying what united us rather than what divided us. So we tended to play down our differences. And I think really what we're discovering now is that we should have been talking about our differences, because what we're discovering is that as things were moving along, we're quite different in some things. I would say, for example, the United Church and the Anglican Church and the Roman Catholic Church differ quite a bit on ethical issues, the whole question of gay marriage, the whole question of abortion, to name only a few of them. Those are things where, having not talked about it, we discover that even if we say we believe the same things, we come to different conclusions of how we are to live. We need to address those issues and those challenges. And we need to reclaim, I guess, our own Catholic dimension in a way that not as defensive or off-putting, although sometimes it comes across that way, but to be clear about what we believe. Because I think it's only in dialogue, only if we face not only our similarities but our differences, that we can really be in an honest relationship. Those are two areas. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that helps or not.
No, in the last few days, the article of Canterbury actually has come out, which has been quite interesting, indicating that he believes that in modern society, different religious judicial systems should be accommodated. What's your feeling on something like that?
Well, I think what he came up with is Sharia law, and I don't think there are too many people who are very excited about that. I think we had a dialogue about that in Ontario, and the government made a decision not to affirm those things. I think we have, in the Roman Catholic Church, have made adjustments so that, for example, if someone is going to apply for an annulment, which the church courts grant, saying that there really wasn't a marriage here, the couple has to go through what we call civil divorce, so that it will not take effect until that. So there has to be a kind of a concordance between what the church says and what the state says. In other words, for the annulment to be valid, there has to be kind of state recognition of that. The flip side is not necessarily the case. The government may, the state may say that there is no marriage, there's a divorce that's granted, but the church may still recognize there's a bond. So I think there's a question of what is the proper interplay between religious law, religious tradition, religious customs, and state laws. And I don't know what the answer to that is. That's the appropriate one. I think people were frightened by what the Archbishop of Canterbury said, perhaps because it's kind of a soundbite. Mm-hmm. We don't really know what his thought is. So since I haven't studied very much, I'd rather not comment on that. But I think we have to deal with these issues, that we live in a multicultural, multi-ethnic, multi-religious culture. We need to find out ways of, A, both affirming our religion, and B, of being members of the state.
The other reason...
I don't prefer to use the term separation of church and state, by the way. I think that's an American concept.
Mm-hmm.
But I think our tradition is different from that, but I think there is some proper spheres that belong to one or the other.
In the last week also, there was a report in Ottawa indicating a growth in the number of youth gangs, and that it's a growing problem. And I'd come back to what we were talking about a few minutes ago, that children or our youths are out there in the educational system, and that the church used to fulfill a need. Have you any thoughts on that scenario?
No, but I think I would be good to test where those young people go to school. If they're in our Catholic schools, that I would say that we need to address that issue of why this kind of behavior takes place in an area where we should be espousing values and inculcating values. How are we failing? How are we succeeding? We need to look at that. I think if it's predominantly children from the public system, I think they need to look at that and say maybe there are values that need to be introduced into the school in a way that respects religious background, but which is also clear. I think one of the things that helps us in our Catholic schools is that we are clear. We do have values and we try to uphold them. And so I'm not saying that the fault is all the public schools, I just don't know. But I think if wherever the lack is, we need to address it. And I think we can do it in the Catholic system. I would hope they could also do it in the public system.
Would you feel then that within the Catholic system that the values that are Catholic values are being adequately transmitted?
I think overall they are. Obviously, any place where we're doing something well, we can do better. I think if we're really falling down some particular school or some particular area, I think we need to address the why. I found in talking with some of our Catholic school board officials that there really is a sensitivity to the special needs. For example, I met with the chaplains from the different the chaplaincy leaders from the different high schools, and they were sharing with me the kind of needs that they address in schools where there's a lot of poor kids,
mm-hmm.
Where there's possibility for bus fares being provided, where there's meals being provided, and so on. In other schools, it's not the case. Maybe it's a more affluent neighborhood and there's less need, but there would probably be other needs in those schools. And so I was quite amazed at the diversity of responses that our schools were showing to the needs of young people. So I would just say we need to figure out where we're falling down and
and address them, either public or private schools.
So over the coming years, what do you put down as your priorities?
Well, I've become known, I suppose, as someone who likes to work with young people, and I'm happy with that. I don't want to be described as a bishop who is only interested in young people. I know we have a lot of middle-aged people, we have a lot of elderly people. I have to be the bishop for everybody, and that means French and English. It means multi-ethnic people. I had a wonderful time with the Chinese community for their New Year. It took much longer than I thought. The dinner went on and on and on, but I also came to appreciate with the Chinese community their sense of playfulness, their sense of music, their sense of joy together. It was quite opening to me. There's a kind of gentleness to the Chinese community that I just saw on that day I spent with them. Not that I didn't think anything of them, that they weren't gentle, but it's just you were touched by it because you saw it actually with their children and with their families and friends and with me. So I guess I'm kind of privileged in that I can see the beauty of each ethnic group, of each culture, each tradition, and I feel honored by that. I wish that was something that everybody could taste. But I've been to the Polish parish, I've been to one of the Italian parishes. I'll be there celebrating St. Patrick's Day at St. Patrick's Basilica. I've got to get a homily up on St. Patrick. And the next day we'll have Mass in French for the celebration of St. Joseph. We decided to do that this year because St. Patrick and St. Joseph both fall in Holy Week, so I have to move them back to the 14th and 15th respectively. So it's kind of a special year for that. But I really am delighting in the variety of our church here. So anyway, so even though youth is one of my priorities in education, I am also trying to be attentive to all the needs of the people. And of course, you can only do so much. And I really count on my priests and the deacons and the religious sisters. They're extraordinary. The bishop probably gets a lot more attention than he deserves, but it's because they make it possible for me. So I must say I've been struck by the welcome that everybody's given me here in Ottawa. I really begun to feel at home. I haven't forgotten Halifax yet. They're still part of my heart because that was my first pastoral ministry as a teacher, and then my first real job as a bishop was down there. So it all has a special heart. When you have a quarter of your life in a particular place, you can't forget about it. But Ottawa has really given me a great welcome.
Archbishop, I've taken enough of your time. I do want to wish you a happy birthday.
Thank you.
Because
is this going to be on before my birthday?
This is on. Your birthday is tomorrow.
Okay.
So have a happy birthday. And Archbishop Terence Prendergast, thank you very much indeed.
God love you. Happy St. Patrick's Day when it comes next month.
Thank you.
You are listening to the Gaelic Hour here on Chin 97.9 FM with Austin Cameron, and the music you heard there in the middle of the interview was Cead Míle Fáilte Rothe Iasa Iasa from Faith of Our Father CD with the Irish Philharmonic Orchestra and Corn an Óg. And that last piece was Tom Brown and The Lark in the Clear Air. This programme will be available on the internet sometime later in the week. Last week's programme, we haven't got it up yet. We're running a little behind, so we should be able to get both programmes up sometime this week. And that is at www.thegaelicr.ca. And we're also podcasting, so if you go on there and hit the podcasting key, it'll bring you through and tell you how to put the file in place in order to automatically download these programs. And all our magazine programs are up there going back to 2005. And we also have a playlist which lists the music that you hear on the program. So if you're trying to figure out what we're playing on the CDs that it's taken from, just go onto the site and hit that button. And we also have a calendar for all the events that are coming up. In addition, we try and keep the schedule up to date. We will be back with you after these messages.
The little Irish village in the heart of the Byward Market had its humble beginnings in 1992 with the now famous Heart and Crown, a second venue, the Snug Pub, since 1997. And then there's Mother McGinty's and Roisin Dubh, the Black Rose. Since 2001, they complete the Irish village, each a treasure in its own way. Visit the Irish village. We can accommodate groups of all sizes, private seating areas, spacious patios, and party rooms. Tell us about your special event and we will take care of the rest. 613-562-0674.
From the Great Wall of China to packed auditoriums in the Holy Land, and now to Ottawa for one performance only, Dervish, direct from Ireland at Library and Archives Canada Auditorium, 395 Wellington Street, at 8 p.m. on Saturday, 23rd of February. Dervish, whose musical genius keeps this group as a leading force in Irish music, bringing the world the joy and excitement and fun that is traditional Irish music. Tickets from Ottawa Folk Festival at 613-230-8234 or visit ottawafolk.org.
And, of course, February 23rd is a busy, busy, busy day. There's a beginner's genealogy course, First Steps, put on by the British Isles Family History Society of Greater Ottawa, and that's at Library and Archives Canada, starting at 9 a.m. And also, of course, as I mentioned at the start of the programme, there is Six Nations Rugby going on, lots of it all day. And then there's at 1 p.m. Cultus Cultoriae, and have a set dance workshop with Maureen Mulvey, and that's at Blessed Sacrament Church over at 194 4th Avenue. And then Irish storyteller and Shanachie Mike Burns will be down at St. Bridget's at St. Patrick's in Cumberland. And that is $20 at the door. And of course, Dervish are up at Library and Archives Canada, and that is put on by the Ottawa Folk Fest. And the other thing that's coming up later on in the month, and that's the Ottawa Welsh Society, the Choral Society, are celebrating their 40th anniversary, and they have a concert at Bromley Road Baptist Church, and tickets for that are $15. But I went out and I sat in on one of their rehearsals earlier in this week, and this is what it was like. Listening to the Gaelic Hour on Chin 97.9 FM with Austin Cameron on the 29th of February at Bromley Road Baptist Church. The Welsh Choir Corps here in Ottawa will be celebrating 40 years. And I have with me Mavanwy Davis and John Griffith, who are two soloists with the choir, as I understand it. And I want you to tell me a little about the choir and some of the history that goes with the choir.
The choir was formed in 1968 and it started by Albert Davis. He's the one that organised the forming of the choir. And that's Mavanwy's father. And then we sort of got a conductor, Roy Morris, the conductor, because we had to get... And then we had an accompanist, Grace Davis. Now, these weren't paid, because we didn't have any money, because we only just started the choir.
Right.
And we started the first rehearsals on Metcalf Street, and we were there for a couple of years, and then we moved to Carlton Memorial on Hog's Back. And then after we were there for a few years, we went to Bromley. Now, the choir went back to Wales in 1973 to compete in Llangollen, which is an international choir and soloist. And Pavarotti has competed there as well. And Bryn Terfel, he's Welsh. And both of them, Bryn Terfel is in, he sings opera in New York, and he's well known.
But John, am I right in assuming that you were around at the in the early days?
I was right from the beginning. Not, I couldn't sing then. I didn't think I could sing.
So the 29th will be a very special night for you to be associated with the choir for 40 years.
Well, the thing is, you don't realise that you've been in a choir for 40 years. I mean, that, yes, I guess it's a big thing that you've been in a choir for 40 years. I mean,
and that a choir can continue to survive for 40 years.
Yes. The unfortunate thing about it, in those days, we were 50 in membership, which is, you can do something 50, and it's very hard for a small choir to sing. So
Mavan, you must be very proud that you are in the choir and that your father was a founder.
Yes. There's been a member of our family in the choir from the beginning, and my mother tells the story that when we moved to Canada, my father threw in 4 copies of Handel's Messiah into the packing boxes, and she asked why, and he said, if I can't find a male voice choir to join, I'm going to start one. But he wasn't able to start a male voice, as there weren't enough, so we are actually a mixed choir, which is a little unusual for Wales, which is known for its male voice choirs. And I personally have been in for 32 years. My mother was in for a long time, and both of my sisters have sung with the choir from time to time. So it's been a family event for a long, long time, and I really enjoy it. I like the variety of music that we have, because we do all sorts of different things. We do a proportion in Welsh. We also do some religious pieces. We do folk songs. We do modern pieces. And it's very interesting to sing in 4 or 5 different languages in one evening in a concert. And in addition to that, I've made a lot of very good friends through the choir. And it's always a joy to come to practice.
Are you finding that it attracts reasonably recent Welsh immigrants?
Well, that is the problem now. There's no Welsh people coming over. And that's why a lot of people that were in the choir have gone back to Wales, and there's no new people coming in. That is our problem.
Yeah. Right now, we have a lot of people that are not born Welsh, but they may have a little Welsh blood in their background, or they enjoy the music. And we welcome them all. We're always looking for new members, and we take the time to go over the pronunciation of the Welsh words with them and have a half hour before practice and fit the words into the music. And a lot of them find they really enjoy it, and then they go back to singing English with different pronunciations, and they have trouble with the words then.
I know that the Friday night concert is the start of a weekend of celebrations.
Right. Yes. That's our part. The rest of it is going to be run mostly by the Ottawa Welsh Society. There is information. They have a website, ottawawelshsociety.com. And on Saturday during the day, there is a genealogy seminar for those interested in finding out about their history. There's also a seminar in the afternoon by Dr. Paul Burt, who is Welsh and heads the Celtic Chair of Studies at University of Ottawa. And he's going to be speaking about keeping your Welsh identity in Canada. But I'm sure the points that he makes would apply to other cultures as well. In the evening, we have our annual dinner and dance, so big chance to get gussied up and meet at the Crown Plaza for roast lamb and dance to a DJ. And then Sunday afternoon, we have our Gaman Vagani, which is a hymn singing service, and that is being held at Westminster Presbyterian, and that's at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Everyone's welcome to come and sing Welsh hymns there and join the fellowship.
And the choir, I presume, participates in that.
Yes, every year they participate in that. We'll be singing a solo and hoping to provide the refreshments afterwards. I have to make Welsh cakes.
So for anyone that would like to come out to the concert on the 29th,
mm-hmm.
Bromley Road is north of Carling,
yep.
And west of Shelburne, I think it is.
Yeah, it's very close to Maitland and Carling.
And what time is the concert at?
Concert starts at 7:30. Tickets are $15 each. They can be picked up at the door, or they can call in advance. They can call my number, which is 613-526-3019.
I'm going to let you get back to your rehearsal because I know time is precious. I'm Evanwy Davis, John Griffiths. Thank you very much indeed for taking the time.
No problem.
And I wish you every success and congratulations on 40 years.
Jochen Bauer.
There, that leads into a Welsh Heritage Weekend, and it gets off to a start with the concert, and that's on Friday evening, Friday 29th at 7:30 out in the Bromley Road Baptist Church. And then there's a, as was mentioned, there's a Welsh genealogy workshop and also the lecture on Welsh identity. So if you go onto the website, thegaelichhour.ca, you'll find details there. Also on the Gaelic Hour website, there's a link through to a DVD, Old Ireland, and this is depicting rural Ireland in the late 40s and early 50s, and this video was made in South Roscommon and East Galway, just outside Ballinasloe, which is my neck of the woods, and it'll bring back memories of the time when many people lived in thatched cottages and turf was the only fuel for cooking and heating, and the cow was milked by hand. And it shows the transition from horse to tractor and how the neighbours gathered together to help each other with the cutting of the turf and the saving of the hay. It's a wonderful DVD, and if you want to purchase a copy, do go on the website and you'll find a link. It'll click through and it will tell you where you can send for details. It's including postage and taxes here in Canada. It is $70, but it's a double CD, two DVDs, and it depicts 12 months of farming in Ireland. Moving along, the other thing that is very much a tradition in Irish culture is Seanos and Seanachie. And I have coming up now Sarah and Rita Keane with some Seanos singing, and we're following that on with an interview with Mike Burns, and Mike Burns will be down at the Canadian Irish Culture Centre, and he is a Seanachie.
Is Nimon Ogatanin Unben Yom Fin Nat Fok Himemoyi Nagusimoch Melum Fin Amatrit Nagu Oh, you'll miss you, sir. I Yul Mishishir Yul Mishakarki Agashraje Balakli Nagasaul de Maharinjas Niyakim Mishiriv Shiyan Vendu Vedag Mahri Kratye Odyairim Mishifin Gaurevla
You are listening to the Gaelic Hour here on Chin 97.9 FM with Austin Cummerton, and that was Sarah and Rita Keane from their CD Once I Loved, and that CD, that track was in the Shannos style of singing. And the other tradition that's very strong in Ireland is that of the Shanachí. And on Saturday evening, down at the Irish Canadian Cultural Centre, Mike Burns will be in town from Montreal. And Mike is originally from Carhartsveen and came over in 1984. And Mike presents himself in the true tradition of a Shanachí. Mike Burns, welcome to the Gaelic Hour on Chin 97.9 FM.
Thank you. My pleasure.
So, Mike, you're from Carhartsveen, and you came over to this wonderful country in 1984. What brought you here?
A woman, Cherchez la femme.
And the standard weakness of a man. And have you been in Montreal for all your time?
I have. Well, I was a year in Boston. I do martial arts. I do Aikido, and I went down to Boston for a year in 87. But other than that, yes, I've been here.
And from then, you grew up in the tradition of the Shanachí.
I did indeed. And keeping it going, and there's a wonderful revival in storytelling now all over the world. So the great thing about that is that I get to go and tell stories all over the place. I was in Lebanon not too long ago, a strange place to be carrying the stories, but in Europe often, in France a lot. I work in French as well as in English, so I get to...
So do you find that there is much interest in the revival of the Shanachí and that people are coming out to listen?
Yeah, there's festivals all over North America and all over Europe now, and thousands of people. Like Wales last summer, the International Storytelling Festival, there 2,000 people for 3 days. The festival here in last October, I think we had 8,000 seats. So there's good numbers, and ongoing events tend to be very well attended as well. I did the Sergent Recruteur, which is probably the center point in Montreal for Francophone storytelling now, a couple of weeks ago, and they were turning people away.
So Mike, while Shanachí and storytelling is very much an oral tradition, the stories that you bring with you and that you share, have you ever put any of them to print, or would you consider doing such?
I have, three or four book CDs in French. So we record the stories, and then the first one, it was my woman that wrote it down then, because my written French is appalling. So the text and the actual storytelling are in the combination of the book CD, and then there's other book CDs since then as well. Those are all on Planète Rebelle. Myself and Toby Kinsler put out a CD a few years back, and there was an anthology of Canadian storytellers a few years back as well, maybe 10 years ago, so I had a story in that, you know. That,
right.
Not often. I there's a friend of mine said, and I think he's right, you know, he said, if you have the stories in the book, he says, it's like canned food. He says, storytelling is a dish best supped fresh.
Right.
There's a very big difference between reading them and hearing them told, you know.
So when somebody comes on Saturday evening, what can they expect to experience?
I think they'll have a good night of it. I know hundreds of stories, and I don't always know what I'm actually going to tell as the menses. I'd have a half notion where I'm going, but then depending on the night, we'll tear into them, and they'll get the cheapest flight back to Ireland for an hour and a half that they'd ever get. That's for sure. Because you get taken there in a sense, you know, like the expressions and the characters and the things that preoccupy any culture. You learn a lot about a people. The Irish people, of course, will find themselves at home, but anybody who's not Irish, they'd get a good notion of what Ireland was about.
So what you're telling me in a lot of ways, Mike, is that you kind of pick up on the mood of the audience and the juices start to flow?
Yeah, it's a lot like a music session, you know. It's a bit like jazz, you know. You have the theme, the basic story, but then you decorate it on it, and you put the grace notes in, and wee phrases come out, and a bit of improvisation here and there, and coming back always to the same to the actual story. The story never gets told twice the exact same way. You still stay true to the story. It's like playing a tune or singing a song. You'd never do it twice exactly the same. You're not a robot, as the man says.
Right. Well, as we mentioned, you're down at St. Bridget's, which is St. Patrick and Cumberland, and that is at 7:30 on Saturday evening, the 23rd, and it's $20 at the door, or you can give a call to 613-562-1243.
Straight into music.
Mike, I've taken enough of your time, and thanks a million, and I hope you have a fantastic night here on Saturday night.
I'm looking forward to it. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Gaelic Hour here on Chin 97.9 FM with Austin Cameron. Do come back and join me again tomorrow night when we have a full night of music. And next Monday night I have a very interesting guest. I will be talking to John Waters about his recently published book called Lapsed Agnostic. It's due to be published in Canada in March. It has been published in England and in Ireland and is doing very well. And as I say, we will be talking to John. I should also be talking to Paddy Keenan next Monday night. I've yet to confirm that he will be back from Africa. I do hope you've enjoyed tonight's show. You can email me if you wish. My email address is austin@thegaelicar.ca. The website is www.thegaelicar.ca, and you will find there the archives, the calendar, the playlist, and the schedule. So until tomorrow night, this is Austin Cameron on Chin 97.9 FM saying good night, and thank you to Max on the other side of the glass, and we look forward to seeing you tomorrow night. Slán go fóill.